supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, one of my pet peeves is we live in a country where excellence is often the minimum acceptable standard and average becomes a four-letter word. We push ourselves to be more, to do more, to achieve more. But what does that do to the way we feel about ourselves or the way we treat ourselves? All of us have a critical voice inside our heads, but most of us, I would guess, are lacking a voice of compassion and understanding. Well, there's new research now that shows us that self-compassion has great implications for overall health and well-being. Still, that inner critic seems to rule us, and not always in a positive way. Today on Voices, we're talking about self-compassion. And before I introduce our guests, I want to play a little montage of voices put together by our intern, Emily Haas. She asked passers-by near the Bourse in Philadelphia, "Are you hard on yourself?" Here's what she heard.
I'm hard on myself, period. If I don't go hard for myself, who will?
It's easy to have compassion on myself simply because I know that I couldn't be any better. Besides which, the Buddha always said, you got to start with self-compassion so you can be compassionate to others.
Every time I beat myself up, whenever I do anything wrong, talking to myself, why did you do that? I need to lighten up a lot.
I smack myself because when I get stuff wrong, I smack myself.
Because you want to get it right, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a good thing that you're hard on yourself.
No.
No, I treat myself good because I like myself.
That was a montage of local voices on the subject of being hard on ourselves. Where is the self-compassion? That's just one of the questions we'll be asking our guest, Kristen Neff. Kristen is an associate professor in human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. Her new book, entitled Self-Compassion, comes out next month. She joins us by phone from Austin. Kristen, welcome to Voices in the Family.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I met you, about 6 months ago, and you weren't even there. I met you when we screened a film here at WHYY called The Horse Boy. And, of course, you and your family were featured on that award-winning documentary. And that was also a best-selling book.
Yes, well, I'm glad you saw that.
It was wonderful. Kristen described her journey with autism of her son, horses, and healing. I highly recommend it. Anyway, to our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. We want to talk about that critical voice inside your head. Is it helpful? Are you obedient to it? How's that work for you? So, Kristen, let's start with, before we talk about self-compassion, let's talk about what compassion is. There are really many elements to it, and the phrase when Clinton was president was, you know, "I hear your pain," but it's really more than that. It's being open to the other person's experience, yes?
Yes, absolutely. So when you feel compassion, you have to, first of all, be able to register and notice other people's pain. Often we're so busy, caught up in our own lives, that we don't even stop to recognize that other people are going through a very hard time. So I really like to think of it as having an open heart, so that when you come in contact with someone else's suffering or pain, your heart responds with a feeling of caring concern. And I think also very important for it to be compassion and not pity is the sense of, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, a recognition that we're all vulnerable, that suffering is part of the shared human condition, that it's not just some unfortunates have problems, we all do, and that allows us to, you know, feel more connected to each other in the imperfection of life.
And compassion is not taking responsibility for someone else's suffering or feeling responsible to fix it, or is it?
No, absolutely. It's not taking responsibility for others' problems. On the other hand, there is an urge, a sense that you want to do what you can, and maybe sometimes you can't do anything other than feel compassionate concern. But even that is giving something to the other person, letting them know that, you know, they're cared for and accepted, even if you can't do anything to actually fix their problem.
Well, I want to take you off on a small tangent here.
Okay.
Relevant to current events. How do we approach what's happening in Japan with an open heart, where we see such devastation?
Yes, well, it's very difficult. And actually, I think you have to really give yourself compassion first before just diving into opening your heart to something so overwhelming. And I've been feeling this too. I mean, how do you really even start to comprehend it? First, you have to open your heart to yourself and let, you know, kind of allow yourself to feel that this is hard to take in. This is difficult. This is really pretty overwhelming. And then once you start soothing yourself and grounding yourself in the fact that, okay, I understand I'm not going to be able to completely open my heart. It's going to take a little time. It's okay. Then slowly you can start to really, you know, I think bit by bit, take in the enormity of what has happened. But I actually think that one shouldn't go too fast. Otherwise, you can get overwhelmed. It's pretty huge what's happened.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I give talks, I very often quote Victor Hugo. There's a line in Les Mis in the book where he says, "In darkness, the pupil dilates as though searching for light. And in adversity, the heart dilates as though searching for God."
Mm.
And I always give that quote at the end of my speeches, because if I gave it in the beginning, I'd have nothing to talk about. But I did grand rounds here at a local hospital, and I did that. There was a cardiologist in the back, and he said, "Well, that's great as a metaphor." He said, "But, you know, the literal heart couldn't stay open. You would die. It has to open and close." And I thought about it, and I thought, so too the metaphorical heart, the spiritual heart. It has to open and close.
Mm.
You agree?
Yeah, no, I do agree. You know, I think it's, first of all, practice to open your heart, but it has to feel safe. If you don't feel safe to open your heart, and there's lots of reasons why we may not be safe to do that, you have to go slowly. I mean, part of being self-compassionate, like I say, is making sure that you aren't overwhelming yourself. And I know caregivers often experience this. You can't just give all the time. You have to do what you can, but also make sure that you take care of yourself in whatever way that looks like.
So the word, let's talk about this self-compassion.
Okay.
The word for compassion, one of the roots is Latin, and it's co-suffering.
Right.
So how can we co-suffer for ourselves?
Right. It really requires a form of perspective taking toward yourself, kind of a meta perspective. So, and I think that's part of the problem, that we're very used to giving compassion to others, but we don't really take the stance of a compassionate other towards ourselves. Of course, we have multiple parts to ourself, our personality, so just as we can criticize ourselves as if we are another person criticizing ourselves, so can we also have compassion for ourselves. So really, it's a way we can relate to ourselves. It may seem like a bit of a paradox, but I think it's something we all experience.
What's that look like, feel like, compassion for ourselves? What's the difference between, say, self-compassion and self-indulgence?
Right. Well, that's a really huge one, because what I found in my research and just talking to people, that people get them very, very confused. So you have to remember that compassion is concerned with the alleviation of suffering, by definition. And so if you are concerned for your own well-being, and if you want to alleviate your suffering, you're going to take actions that are promote your health and well-being. Now, self-indulgence does not promote your health and well-being. You know, if you just said, okay, I'm going to sit around all day and watch TV reruns and eat tons of ice cream, that's not good for you. That's not good for your health and well-being, and that would actually cause you more suffering. So the self-compassion does motivate you very strongly, but the motivation comes from a sense of care, a sense of wanting what's best for you. Self-indulgence is not caring. It's something quite different. It's not concerned with your health and well-being.
We're talking with Kristen Neff, who's an associate professor of human development culture at University of Texas in Austin, and we're talking about self-compassion, caring for ourselves, understanding when we suffer. Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. Do you feel compassion for yourself, or are you more likely to judge yourself harshly? 888-477-9499. We'll be going to the phones in just a few minutes, so please call early in the show. Kristen, you know, we psychologists got a bad reputation when we began advocating for nurture and praise for our children, ourselves, and everyone else. I mean, it gave birth to the touchy-feely reputation, that stuff that gave back birth to Al Franken, Stuart Smalley, you know?
Right.
So there's the risk here. I mean, if I feel self-compassion, you know, is that just touchy-feely? You know, I've got work to do. I need to achieve more and accomplish more.
Right. Well, luckily we have research on our side. And there's lots of research showing that self-criticism is not a good motivator. And again, it's good you brought up the example of how parents motivate their children. Let's say your son came home with a failing exam grade, and your son wants to go to college, so this isn't a good thing. And you told your son, you're such a lazy good-for-nothing, you'll never amount to anything. That's not going to motivate your son. It's going to depress him. It's going to cause him to stop believing in himself. And it's not very likely to motivate him to try harder, at least in a healthy way. Whereas if a parent is encouraging, supportive, firm, you know, we need to get you a better study routine because we want you to get better grades so you can get to college. If the parent, you know, shows support, love, concern for the child, that child's going to be in the safe emotional space to try and to try again and even risk failure, which you need to do if you're going to learn and grow. So we can see it in terms of how we treat our children. I mean, nowadays, we didn't used to. Nowadays, we see that. And we need to take that stance for ourselves. And again, the research shows that self-criticism causes depression, not exactly a get-up-and-go mind state, causes us to lose faith in ourselves, causes us to have fear of failure, which means we don't try. Whereas people who are more self-compassionate are more willing to take responsibility for their mistakes. They're more often, you know, get up and try again when they fail to reach a goal. They're much more oriented towards growth and fulfilling their potential. So, yes, it is a feel-good idea, but there's research to back up that it works.
When I do an intake on a new client or a consultation, one of my questions often is, tell me about your relationship with yourself. And many people are taken aback at first. But deep down, I mean, they all know exactly what I mean. You know, many of them, though, have never thought about the quality of their relationship with themselves.
That's right.
Is that pretty universal?
Yes, it almost amazes me, too, that people don't even hear their self-critical voice. They're so used to it that when I ask people to start thinking about what you say, you know, what do you say to yourself, they're really kind of shocked. And then you ask the question, would you ever use that language or that tone of voice to a good friend, someone you cared about? And they say, absolutely not. And then, of course, sometimes you say, does the voice remind you of anyone? And sometimes it is a figure in one's past that they've kind of internalized, maybe a mother's voice or a critical father or something like that. So, you know, big step in this process is just being aware of how you relate to yourself. As you say, that's huge.
It's interesting. Most people I know, personally and professionally, they don't question the authority of that voice. They just assume it's true.
That's right. And often because they internalized it when they were young, they didn't really have the power to question.
Yeah.
And also our culture encourages it. I think our culture subtly tells us that we're good people if we're hard on ourselves, that we're self-sacrificing. Even though, again, if you look at it more logically, more objectively, it doesn't make any sense at all that it's good to be hard on yourself, just as it's not good to be cruel and unkind to other people.
You might not have this answer, but to what extent is this a cultural issue? You know, the allegation is that the first time the Dalai Lama came here, he said he was struck that people over here didn't like themselves very much. And he said, how can you not like yourself when everybody has a Buddha nature inside, a piece of the divine? Is it a cultural issue?
Well, we have a little bit of data on that. I mean, it's still early days, but we did a study looking at self-compassion in Thailand, Taiwan, and the United States. And Thailand is the most Buddhist of the countries. They really take their mm-hmm. Buddhism seriously there. And they definitely were the most self-compassionate. Perhaps surprisingly, Taiwan was the lowest, which has more of a Confucian ethic, which actually does emphasize self-criticism in the culture. And the United States was in between. What was interesting, though, is in all three cultures, self-compassion was very strongly related to well-being. So I think, self-compassion is the usefulness of it, the emotional well-being associated with that is universal, but how much different cultures emphasize that does seem to differ.
We're talking about self-compassion with Kristen Neff, an associate professor of human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. Our number is 888-477-9499. Kristen, let's see if we can get a call in before we have to go to break. Let's see if we can talk with Nancy.
Hi. When you're in the middle of a storm of self-hatred, how do you care enough about anything except the intensity to get out of it?
For me, it helps just to remember kindness. Sometimes when I just feel like I'm so overwhelmed with negative emotions or shame, I just try to remember kindness. I even have a little set of phrases I say to myself, which you can memorize. My phrases are, this is a moment of suffering. Suffering is part of life. May I be kind to myself in this moment. May I give myself the compassion I need. So if you set your intention to try to change the way you relate to yourself, if you have a little set of memorized phrases, you can just tap into them, maybe have it pinned around notes around your house. So you have to take a little break and step out of the storm of negativity and self-hate and just really set your intention to be different. Putting your hand over your heart can also be very powerful, some sort of physical gesture to break the spell.
Or touching your face. Nancy, who do you love most of all in this world?
I'm not sure.
Okay, name one.
Well, there's a cat I'm very fond of.
Okay, well, cats. What I'm trying to get to is, what would you do if someone you really loved, you really cared about, was engaged in a storm of self-criticism? What would you do for them?
I would try to talk them out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you what I would want.
Yeah.
Just in case the next time we're together and I get off in a storm of self-criticism, would you just hold my hand and look in my eye and care?
Yeah, that can help.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could possibly do that for yourself. You know, this self-criticism, a lot of research, and I'm sure Krista knows much more than I do, is about brain chemistry. And when you do that, you know, your brain is caught in a endless loop that can go over and over and over again. And it's, you know, it's just a brain thing going on. It's not you. It's not even your mind. It's just chemicals in your brain, and you're stuck in this loop. And, you know, it's exactly what Kristen said. You're suffering then. And, you know, touch your face, touch your heart. Hold your hand. Try to gaze into your own eye.
There is a lot of research showing, too, that touch, compassionate touch, actually releases oxytocin, which is the chemical release when a mother gently rocks and holds her child. And that oxytocin directly counters all the cortisol and, you know, physiological response related to the self-criticism. So actually, even if you feel like you can't go there and be kind to yourself, your body can respond to a gentle touch, a gentle caress. So it's often a really good place to start.
Nancy, thanks so much for your call, and I do wish you the best. Be kind. Take care. Kristen, we've got to take a short break. We're going to be back. We've got lots of callers who want to talk more with you and me and about self-compassion. I do want to say, you mentioned with Nancy about oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
I was aware that in that moment when I asked her who she loved, and there was a moment of silence, and when she came back, her voice cracked a little bit.
Mm.
I felt my heart open. I felt oxytocin being released in my brain. You know, I felt open
and
trusted.
Yes, both giving and receiving compassion releases oxytocin.
Yeah, it doesn't matter which way it goes.
Exactly, and this is, as mammals, we're all born with this ability to both give and receive care. So even when people think they aren't capable of it, they actually are. It's in our body.
Yeah, it's just a question of finding it.
That's right.
We've got to, like I said, take a 1 minute break. My guest is Kristen Neff. She's an associate professor of human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. She's got a new book titled Self-Compassion that comes out next month, and I'm confident you can pre-order that online. Well, our number is 888-477-9499. If our lines are busy, please keep trying, because we'd love to hear from you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Paoli Hospital supports WHYY. Paoli Orthopedics consists of a team of physicians with more than 300 years of experience, certified nurses, physical therapists, and more, serving Chester County and beyond. Paoli is certified by the Joint Commission for Hip and Knee Replacement and designated as a Blue Distinction Center by Blue Cross Blue Shield for hip and knee replacement as well as spine surgery. Details online at mainlinehealth.org/paoliortho and about Blue Distinction at bcbs.com. Mainline Health. Well ahead.
No other media outlet equals WHYY when it comes to trusted news, in-person arts and culture experiences, and being a safe haven for our children to learn in. If Congress votes to eliminate all federal funding for public media, that very experience is at risk. Visit WHYY.org to learn more about 170 million Americans, a group dedicated to ending the threat facing PBS, NPR, and WHYY. Thank you.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking today with Kristen Neff about self-compassion. She's got a book coming out next month by that same title. She's an associate professor of human development and culture at University of Texas in Austin. I want to talk about self-esteem for a minute before we go back to the phones.
Okay.
You know, in the 60s, there was a big push towards fostering self-esteem, and it still continues in many families. And now we know self-esteem doesn't correlate much with anything. It doesn't correlate with happiness or well-being. My guess is, you know, Muammar Gaddafi has pretty good self-esteem. Hitler had pretty good self-esteem, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's certainly the case that if you have low self-esteem, if you hate yourself, that's going to be associated with things like depression and anxiety. But what they're finding is that rather than high self-esteem causing happiness and well-being, it's more that when you're happy and everything's going well, then you have high self-esteem, so the directionality goes the other way. And the problem, of course, is not with feeling good about yourself, it's how you feel good about yourself, why you feel good about yourself. And in our culture, we need to all be special and above average, just as baseline, which means that we've got this tendency, which psychology has documented very powerfully, to see ourselves through rose-colored glasses, to see ourselves as better than others. We also have a tendency to try to put others down, to see others as worse than us, all the way to prop up our self-esteem. And that can lead to some pretty nasty things like bullying. Bullies have high self-esteem. Mm-hmm. People who are aggressive, that they get their high self-esteem by putting others down quite violently sometimes. It's the most narcissistic generation of college students ever recorded.
Yes.
Because of all the emphasis on high self-esteem. So, you know, thinking you're better than others has some real serious problems, both for yourself and also for society at large.
Well, I just gave a talk on happiness to a pretty large audience. And I said to them, you know, I asked them by show of hands, how many remember the bell curve? And almost all of them did. And I said, well, guess what? Almost all of us are under the big hump together. You know, so
right.
You know, live with it. You know,
that's right.
But beyond self-esteem, you talk about self-worth and how stable that emotion is, and I think without even knowing it, I think that's what, you know, we're striving for, isn't it?
That's right. A kind of unconditional core sense of worth that comes from being a human being, not from being, you know, special and above average. And in fact, if you don't mind me talking briefly about research, we did a study where we tracked people's sense of self-worth over 8 months. We tracked it 12 times. And self-compassion predicted the stability in self-worth. Self-esteem predicted nothing. So it's not how much you like yourself. It's feeling that you are human being worthy of kind, compassionate care that seems to give you that stable sense of being worthy.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Drew on the line. Hey, Drew.
Hello, Kristen.
Hello, Drew.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Drew.
I had a question regarding how might someone help an individual that's getting older who has a lot of compassion for others but yet doesn't have compassion for themselves?
I'd like you to tackle that, Kristen, but first I want to tag on another question for you. Is that really possible to have compassion for others if you don't have it for yourself?
Well, it actually seems to be. In our research, we find a lot of people, especially caregivers, very good caregivers, are quite practiced at being compassionate towards others who are very hard on themselves. Now, it's my personal belief, and hopefully we'll have some data soon to show this, that the compassion is deeper, more open-hearted for others when you can also open your heart to yourself. I think it goes to another level. But it's really almost shocking, and maybe especially among women who have less self-compassion for themselves, less self-compassion than men, and more compassion for others, and the real discrepancy between giving out to others and how you treat yourself. So in terms of helping someone, it often just really helps to point that out. I mean, would you treat a dear friend this way? And then most people say, well, no, I wouldn't. And then you can just get people thinking about, well, why do you treat yourself this way? Do you think this is helping yourself or harming yourself? And often just getting people to realize, think about this fact can help them start to change the way they relate to themselves.
I would also piggyback on top of that, Drew, to approach this person with an open heart and a curious mind so that you could ask her, well, what's it like when you do that? What's it feel like when you offer compassion for someone else? And what's it feel like when you beat yourself up or deprive yourself? And perhaps you could talk about what you feel like when he or she does that, what impact that has on you. Just go beyond just asking him or her to change their behavior. You there?
You're a good therapist, aren't you?
You there? You there, Drew?
I am, yes, and that's great insight. I think a lot of it is what you're saying is to create that dialogue and get them talking about it and how they're feeling towards others and then about themselves.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Truth. And also, I find that, again, a lot of people aren't even aware of the suffering they cause themselves through their self-criticism. So just getting people to become more attuned to their suffering can help them have compassion for it. But if you don't even notice it, you can't really have compassion for, the pain you're in, even though it's self-inflicted pain.
Drew, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you both.
I want to tell you a story, Kristen, about my grandson, who is also on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
When he was about 4 or 5, he had, one of his meltdowns that you know so well. So
yeah.
His body got rigid, he got filled with rage, and he threw people out of the room. But he let his mother and I stay in, and finally he just collapsed and started sobbing. And he turned to his mother and he said, no, he was much older. He had to be about 6 or 7. He said, Mommy, everything went too fast inside my head today.
Mm, wow.
And I think what's poignant about that is he was suffering and he knew it. We suffer and we don't know it.
Mm.
And, that's good news and bad news.
Yeah, and I know you found the same thing. One of the real gifts of autism is there's not the burdening of a sense of self, of protecting one's self-esteem. There's a real ability to actually see things clearly because you aren't trying to create a storyline. I think autistic kids really do live in the moment,
right,
which is why there's so much to learn from them. Just a response to a kind of a similar story. My son has started helping me deal with my emotions because sometimes I say things with a kind of a stern expression when I don't mean it. And now he just says, say it with a happy face, Mommy.
Isn't that great?
So beautiful. I'm not even aware I have this expression, and he's tuned into it. He tells me, hey, you just say it with a happy face.
Who would have guessed that you would give birth to your own therapist?
You know, it's really amazing. Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line. Hi, John. John?
Hi there.
Hi.
I am a psychotherapist about a year into my practice, and I took my training at Eastern University just outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And one of the core components of the way we were trained to do psychotherapy is to, over a period of time, really look for an individual's core belief about themselves. And oftentimes, folks who are in therapy have a pretty dark core belief about who they are. You know, whether it's, I'm disgusting, I'm, horrible, it could be any sort of thing. And in our training, what we were taught to do was to find ways to adjust, in the technical language, reframe that core belief. But what I found most poignant about that is that it's important to find something that's true about that person. So if you find the core belief to be, I'm disgusting, the therapist can't simply say, I wonder if you can start to think about yourself as beautiful. You really have to search and find something about that person that is true and then offer them that evidence, really. It's not just you trying to make them feel better. So, and this has been very big in my life, as I search through what kind of brings on the storms of negative self-talk. I have to search my life and find something that's true about myself. So, for example, I'll often go to the simple fact that I've committed my life and invested an incredible amount of time and energy into helping other people. So whatever I might be feeling down on myself about, I can go to that point, that actually I'm a fairly good person. I've invested, $60,000 in graduate training to try and help other people. And so I just wanted to throw that out there and offer that to the conversation. I don't know, Dan or Kristen, if you have any thoughts on that.
Listen, We're both psychologists. Of course we have thoughts about that. John, thanks so much for your call. Kristen?
Well, I know the type of therapy he's referring to, which teaches people to change their thoughts about themselves, and that is useful, definitely, but there is a limitation in that basically the more you try to suppress a thought or maybe get rid of it, the more powerfully it seems to emerge. It's very, very hard to change our thoughts. The thing about self-compassion is it doesn't deny or try to change anything. It actually turns toward the pain that's generated by those negative thoughts, holds it, embraces it with compassion, allowing the negativity of the thought to kind of heal on its own. It's almost something magical that occurs, but, you know, and this is part of the whole mindfulness movement, which I'm sure you're very aware of. Turning towards embracing the pain actually allows it to heal as opposed to just trying to get rid of the pain, which seems to sometimes even make it worse.
I had a patient several years ago, and she was talking about her core belief. She'd been working with me for about 6 weeks, and I'd grown quite fond of her. And she was talking about her core belief, and it really was this kind of loathing that we heard about, this kind of self-hatred. And without even thinking, I welled up with tears.
Mm.
It was just great sadness over this kind woman who was suffering so much. And it was my tears that opened something up in her.
Interesting.
So that she was able to feel more compassion for herself. She kind of piggybacked on my compassion.
Mm, yes, opening to the pain caused by our self-criticism,
Our
self-hate.
One of our callers wanted to know about the difference between self-compassion and self-pity.
Yes.
Feels good.
The huge difference is self-pity's poor me, where self-compassion has this real grounding in the sense of common humanity. You know, life is difficult for everyone. Everyone is imperfect. So it's not self-focused and self-absorbed the way self-pity is. It's really opening. It's very much more interconnected with everyone else's experience. So it doesn't exclude others. It actually connects the self with others. It feels very, very different. And it also feels... It feels a lot better. I mean, I know when I've gone through times of suffering, if I can remember that this is part of the human experience, it's not that something has gone wrong. It's not that I'm abnormal. This is normal. This is the way life is supposed to be. Everyone experiences suffering. Then you don't feel so alone and isolated in that experience. So.
Let's take another call before we have to go to break. Bob, we've got Bob on the line.
Yeah, this is Bob. Love your discussion.
Thank you.
My question is there a correlation between a high achiever, a high achieving adult or young adult, and self-loathing? You know, my son is a high achiever in every sense, athletically, educationally, but he's sort of in a depressive funk, which I've identified, you know, as a self-loathing type of situation. So I wonder if there's any correlation between high achievers and self-loathing.
Kristen?
Yes. So it sounds like he's a bit of a perfectionist, and there's a lot of research showing there's kind of more adaptive perfectionism and very maladaptive perfectionism. So adaptive perfectionism is as people who strive and try to reach their highest potential, but are kind to themselves, admit that sometimes they fail. They aren't bothered by not reaching their goals, but they still have very high, you know, lofty goals. Whereas maladaptive perfectionists really push themselves, and they are devastated when they don't reach their goals. And that is associated with both depression, anxiety, fear of failure, and eventually can kind of pull the rug out underneath someone, so that eventually they'll have a failure and they won't be able to get back up
again. So it sounds like one of them is about kind of realizing your dreams or reaching for your dreams, and the other is about staying a step ahead of your demons, of your fears,
fears
of failure. So, Bob, if that's the case, you know, your son, with your help, maybe professional help, needs to take a look at his fear of failure and maybe help him with that. Okay? Thanks so much for your call, Bob. I appreciate it. Kristen, we've got to take a short break. We'll be back. I want to talk about self-compassion and diet, too. I know you've done some research in that. My guest today is... Sorry?
Oh, okay. Great.
My guest is Kristen Neff, Associate Professor of Human Development and Culture at the University of Texas in Austin. Her book's coming out next month. It's called Self-Compassion. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Joint Replacement Program at Paoli Hospital supports WHYY and offers comprehensive services that emphasize wellness and maximize patient recovery through education, expectation setting, family involvement, and group interaction. Patients benefit from experienced surgeons and magnet-designated nurses, personalized attention, as well as all private rooms with room service. To learn more, mainlinehealth.org/PaoliOrtho. Mainline Health, well ahead.
They say they are real-life superheroes out to stop crime. They've got the martial arts moves, they even have the cool costumes, but they say it's not about being cool and kicking butt.
It's not necessarily the ability to beat somebody up. It's to defuse a situation so that nobody's getting hurt.
Are they the real deal or just two guys who like to dress up? We'll ask them next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about self-compassion with Kristen Neff, who's got a book coming out by that same title. She's an associate professor of human development at the University of Texas in Austin. I wanted to talk with you, Kristen, about food, diet, and self-compassion, but it looks like we've got a caller who's got a more specific question on that same topic. Michael?
Yeah, hi, great show.
Thank you.
I'm wondering what the correlation is between the food we eat and how we act as people. I'm an organic farmer here in the area of Philadelphia, and I've learned more recently that, you know, we are what we eat. And I'm just wondering what research has been done that can, you know, that you know of that has this relevance.
Well, thank you for your call, Michael. Let's talk about self-compassion and our relationship with food, Kristen.
Well, this is actually a pretty new area of research. People are looking at self-compassion and health behaviors more generally, eating well, exercising, quitting smoking. And so far, the research really suggests that people who are more self-compassionate, they actually are, let's say they have weight loss goals, they are better able to stick with them. If they break their diet for some reason, instead of just getting depressed and engaging in emotional eating, basically binge eating, because it's like, oh, I blew my diet, I might as well just eat that whole bag of M&Ms, they're more able to stick to their goals. They tend to exercise for the right reasons, because they care about themselves, because they want to be healthy, not just because they want to, you know, look super thin and impress other people. And they've done this great study where people who are more self-compassionate were trying to quit smoking were, again, much more able to stick to the goals of quitting smoking. So it seems to really encourage this desire for the self's health and well-being, and then behaviors that you know, meet those goals.
Well, my instinct, let me weigh in as someone who, say, is on a diet and failed with smoking or even mm-hmm. drugs or alcohol. So, you know, I can feel all the compassion I want, but all of my instincts are going to say, damn it, I've got to work harder here. I've got to try even harder.
Well, compassion doesn't mean not trying hard. Again, I think sometimes people get that confused. If you really care about yourself and you don't want to suffer, sometimes you have to work very hard. Sometimes you have to go through some pretty painful experiences, you know, nicotine withdrawal, et cetera. But you do it, the motivation for doing it is not because you're unworthy if you have these problems. it's because you really care about yourself, and it's a much more sustainable, long-lasting way of motivating yourself. But it doesn't mean no pain. I mean, I think that's a mistake. Going easy on yourself means don't beat yourself up emotionally, but maybe you do have to work really hard, and that's okay. That's part of being human as well.
If it's smoking, you want to work really hard because you want to be kind to your lungs, kind to your body. Same with eating or anything.
Exactly. It's really getting in touch with your care for yourself, and that's going to lead to more healthy behaviors.
Let's go to the phones again. We've got Armand on the line.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. This is a tremendous show today, and one dear to my heart, my daughter, who for the past month has been considering taking her own life because of having a severe nightmare that she had visions of killing both myself and my wife and people near and dear to her. And we've sought out some help, but she has now been placed on some light medication, but don't know why she's having these experiences and can't shake these dark thoughts of her going out and harming someone that she loves so much.
Is she still having these thoughts, Armand?
Yes. Yes.
And what kind of treatment is she getting?
Well, we're going to try to get her into some form of therapy as quickly as possible, and she just about 3 weeks to a month ago successfully completed a rigorous state examination that got her a license to help people and work in the health field, and then all of a sudden had this horrible dream that she has now not been able to shake.
How old is she?
30.
Well, it's important that she know and that you understand that what's happening with her is not about who she is, that this is a disorder. Something's going on in her brain that's triggering these thoughts and emotions, and there are very effective treatments that can help her. The phrase I use is put out the fire that's going on in her brain. But the treatment needs to be aggressive, and it needs to be done quickly, because the longer it goes on, the more difficult it's going to be to put out the fire. I would get her into treatment as quickly as possible, get her on the right medications, and have her and her therapist decide together what the treatment needs to look like, whether it should be outpatient or inpatient. But I can't stress enough how urgent this is to get her into the right kind of treatment very quickly.
I certainly appreciate that, and we are going to do that. And I took lots of notes, and I think that the exact idea of putting her hand over her heart and feeling what a lovely person she really is would be enough to help her, you know, understand these thoughts that she has supportive parents that have been together for over 35 years and support her in every single way, emotionally, financially, every way you can.
Armand, it might help her understand that she's not alone with this, if you can touch her heart and have her touch yours.
And make sure you give yourself compassion for it. What an incredibly difficult experience. I hear it in your voice. No, I know all your attention is taken up with helping your daughter, but make sure you take time to really give yourself compassion for this really difficult experience. I'm so sorry.
Armand, please take care, and I wish the best for you and your whole family. That's pretty painful stuff and pretty frightening stuff.
Yes.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call on. We've got Mary on the line.
Hi. Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to just say that for me, there was a profound change in my life in my early 30s when one day I just felt like I just couldn't do it anymore. Who would care? And what happened is I did pick up the Bible, and there was a Psalm there, 139, and I read it. And in the end, the last little phrase, it says, "Wondrous have I made you." And it struck so deep, so deep, that I was wonderfully made, no matter who thought what. And at the time, I was going through a very difficult time at work, in my marriage. People, you know, it's just a lot of people coming negative at me. So I just wanted to share that with you. That's been challenged many times during my years since, but it has always been, I've always gone back to that. And even with my children, some of them have gone through severe situations. It's helped me to listen to them better when I can go back and say, "Wondrous have I made you," and maybe share with them, be with them through it, but share with them as I'm going through it.
Wonderful. Mary, thank you so much. Thank you so, so much. And Kristen, I have to say thank you to you, too. You've been wonderful. And I just want to make an observation. The tone in your voice, the cadence in your voice, says everything about who you are. It says you walk the walk. You're not just talking about this stuff.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm just such a fan of yours. I really am. You're bringing something beautiful to the world.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I wish you the best and great happiness. And send my regards to Rowan, too.
I will. Rowan. I will. He is just doing fabulously. So thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
My guest today has been Kristen Neff. She's an associate professor in human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. Her book, Self-Compassion, comes out next week. She was featured in an award-winning documentary and best-selling book called The Horse Boy. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about prolonged adolescence. Well, if you've got a question or show idea, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Emily Haas is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.